The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antonio.
Welcome, good morning, morning glory, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, and I am revitalized. Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I got to go to a movie yesterday for the first time in 15 months. Now, this comes from a trailer for The Wrath of Man, Guy Ritchie's new film starring Jason Statham. And it's a heck of a trailer. Now, Nomadland, I'll tell you about a little bit later, which is what we saw, and it does deserve to be seen on a big screen, but I'm just happy that the theaters are back open, along with the news, which I'll tell you about in just a second, out of New York. It's just great that normal life is returning to America. However, according to the New York Times, let's do the rundown. Reaching herd immunity is unlikely in the United States, experts believe, even though half of adults in America have been inoculated with at least one dose of the vaccine. Experts are coming to the conclusion that rather than making a long-promised exit, the virus will most likely become a manageable threat that will continue to circulate in the United States for years to come, still causing hospitalizations and deaths, according to the New York Times, but in much smaller numbers. In fact, New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey are going to let most businesses fully reopen in mid-May. New York City will return to 24-hour subway service. Broadway will be back. However, the FDA is also set to authorize the Pfizer biotech vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds next week. That is terrific, terrific news. That means high school sports in the fall. There is this great news out of New York, and the Financial Times has a wonderful picture of four young women, appears to be actresses, down at the Times Square, hands raised. The theater world rejoices. Now, of course, it'll take some time to get these things reopened. The number of new COVID-19 infections hit a peak of about 95 per 100,000 people in New York on January 12th. It's down to 17. That's far further down than last year when Broadway and the rest of the great Big Apple had to close. We wish them well in a speedy return. Meanwhile, Ron DeSantis, Florida governor, been a vocal critic of strict lockdowns and state control as opposed to local control, signed a bill that puts new curbs on officials' emergency power during a pandemic, effectively ending all local restrictions in the state. But when Governor Cuomo stunned Broadway and the cultural world by lifting restrictions, reopening is just going to be a major, major big deal for the rest of the country as well. That sets the pace. In Washington, D.C., for example, the Kennedy Center last month unveiled a vast Broadway caliber roster for its 21-22 season in October, beginning with Hadestown. John Andrazik and Five for Fighting are going back on the road. We're going to just play Five for Fighting songs all day long. Now, I hope they make the Birchmere in Virginia. I know they're going to the Coach House in Southern California down in San Juan Capistrano, but who knows? They'll just keep adding dates. That's great news. Moderna is going to provide 500 million vaccine doses to anyone around the world, especially COVAX, the International Vaccine Sharing Initiative that aims to distribute to the poor and middle-income countries. President Biden has raised the refugee admissions cap to 62,500. Bill and Melinda Gates are ending their marriage after 27 years. They asked for privacy. I will at least respect that request. The European Union has reopened, has recommended opening travel to foreigners so that member states open their borders. We don't know if it's going to happen. The member states are set later this week to debate the proposal. The bloc's executive arm, the European Commission, recommended it. India, however, remains just a humanitarian disaster. Experts say uncontrolled outbreaks like India's also threaten to prolong the pandemic worldwide. by allowing more dangerous virus variants to mutate. The India broke the 400,000 mark yesterday with 401,993 new cases. Just extraordinary. Less than 2% of the population has been vaccinated in India. Australia is so worried about that number that it has threatened its citizens with jail and a $50,000 fine if they return from India in the near future. That's the first time, actually, in international law that we've seen a country barring the return of its own citizens. Social media in India is awash in cries for help. But many people don't get any help. But many people are, in fact, finding help via the web. That is good news. Hillary Clinton has warned of huge consequences in the Afghan surge withdrawal. It's a wicked problem, Ms. Clinton told CNN. Because, of course, the rise of the Taliban anywhere means the suppression of women everywhere that the Taliban rules. And former Secretary Clinton is aware of that. Germany is loosening COVID restrictions for vaccinated people, lifting curfews and limits on gathering that discriminate against people. About 23.5 million people have received at least one dose of the vaccine. In fact, the country that is most screwed up at this moment in the developed world, and India is a developed country, but it's also a non-developed country in many parts of its rural region, is Canada. Canada, that vaunted healthcare system to the north, which we love dearly. Canada is cousin, right? They've been with us in every war. They are dearly loved. My daughter-in-law is a naturalized American citizen from Canada. I love her parents as well. But Canada has really screwed up its COVID response, and it's a reversal of how Canadians felt during the Trump early months of the COVID. They used to sling arrows at Trump and Team Trump. In fact, Team Trump was developing the vaccine that has saved the world via Operation Warp Speed, two of them, in fact. And the restaurants, the Toronto hospital has begun moving patients to other hospitals in the past few days as oxygen supplies dwindled. Ontario's Premier Doug Ford has overseen a shambolic pandemic response that has whipsawed businesses and tourists and residents for months and months. The second state of emergency was declared in January. So around the world, uneven news. Most of the West, save COVID, crushed Canada in good places. Now to a bigger story, I mean physically bigger and longer. Lousy demographics mark China, but it will not stop China's rise, according to Gideon Rockman in the Financial Times. It has a very low fertility rate in China, very, very low. A large, expanding, youthful population usually is necessary to drive a nation to superpower status or dominant power status that doesn't exist in China, but technological prowess will be what makes the difference there. By 2040, however, around 30% of the country will be over 60. That is not good. That's an enormous burden for them to take care of. In the United States, about 10,000 people a day are turning 65. Then finally, a new controversy is breaking out all over the United States. As schools expand, quote, racial equity work, conservatives see a new threat in critical race theory. It's not conservatives. It's anybody who cares about education. The story from the Washington Post follows one in the NBC yesterday about the vote in Southlake, Texas, where opponents of anti-racism education fired the entire school board and city council. The Washington Post story says the nation's reckoning over race has reached thousands of U.S. schools, and so too has a conservative backlash. Again, I do not believe it is accurate to call it a conservative backlash. I believe it's a parent's backlash. They want the three R's. They want their kids to have advanced math, which has been outlawed in Virginia by a woke Department of Education. They do not want wokeness thrust upon their kids. They do not want wokeness perverting educational curriculum. They want excellence. In particular, conservatives, again, this is the Post, have seized on the idea that schools are promoting critical race theory, a decades-old academic framework that examines how policies and law perpetuate systemic racism. That is also, this is an ill-conceived article in my newspaper, and I say my newspaper because I write for it. Decades-old academic framework should have said decades-old, marginal, and absolutely worthless, bizarre framework, critical race theory, and defenders of what's going on in the anti-racism campaign say, oh, we're not critical race theory. Yes, yes, you are. Race is in everything. And the idea that students ought to bear the wokeness of their faculty is one of the controversies that will define the next political cycle. As parents want their kids, who have already lost a year of their education because of teachers' union and bad public policy, do not want woke teacher unions and woke school districts to destroy the next year of their education with, you know, basically cultural revolution style self-criticism. Huge political issue unfolding across the United States. We'll talk about it on today's Hugh Hewitt Show. Stay tuned. Lots ahead. Hey, man, send me a song. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Five for fighting on back on the road. That makes me happy. But you know what made me sad? Well, both happy and sad. The Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I were able for the first time in 15 months to resume our habit of movie going. We are high consumption movie people. You know, my job is over at 9 a.m. in the morning unless I'm writing a Washington Post column or doing an event for Salem, or tonight the Nixon seminar is available. We're having a special meeting in the Nixon seminar devoted to how the National Security Council operates, should operate, has operated. That's available for people who belong to the Nixon Foundation. Check it out at nixonseminar.com or nixonfoundation.org. It's a wonderful, wonderful hour and a half with the 15 most accomplished center-right national security professionals under the age of 50. Chaired by former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, and Honorary Chairman Henry Kissinger. And the first meeting was with Dr. Kissinger, and the second meeting tonight was with Peter Thiel, investor-entrepreneur, and it was extraordinary. Tonight, it's just the seminar members focusing in on the NSC. Now, we've got one former NSC member, two former deputies, one former chief of staff, and many former participants. So it's a really interesting national security deep dive. But there's not always good programming to watch like the Nixon seminar. And so movies really did make up a large part of our life for our soon to be 39 years of married life. And my kids are movie nuts. And the boys and I go to see things like The Wrath of Man and The Fetching Mrs. Hewitt, and I see everything else. None of the Hewitts are geared for horror or slasher films. We just all like movies. The Wrath of Man is a weekend movie coming up, like Mortal Kombat was 2 weekends ago. And Nomadland, yesterday we said, let's go. Got the 5 o'clock show in the suburbs of Virginia. Theater is about 1/3 full, which is fine. Everyone our age, you know, between 50 and 70, the people who love movies and grew up on movies and could never stop going to movies if they wanted to. And this is the best picture, right? So I didn't want to watch it. And Frances McDormand, who is the best actress, made an appeal for people to see movies on the big screen. And this is a movie you should see on the big screen. It's just breathtakingly beautiful. Also grief-filled and sad. And it's grief-filled and sad. Spoiler alert, if you don't want to know anything about Nomadland, just turn it off for a couple of minutes. But I won't give away much. It's about a widow making her way in the world after her husband dies and the town in which they have lived forever shuts down because U.S. Gypsum closes the sheetrock plant. And what's notable about this, you know, we talk about movies afterwards, is that there's absolutely not a whisper of God, not a whisper of a faith community. She's not a Roman Catholic. She's not a Protestant. She's not any variant of any faith tradition. She's not Jewish. She's not Muslim. She's not Buddhist. She's nothing. Doesn't say that she's an atheist, but she's got no church home. She has very little family. And she is clearly, some people are called to the single life. Some people are called to vocations. If you're called to a vocation, you're a priest or a a Roman Catholic sister, you will live in community and have community around you. But if you're called to the single life, you've got to work very hard at friends, both horizontal and vertical, above you and below you. In fact, you got to work at friends above you and below you, no matter where you are. But she does not have anything. And so she begins the nomad life. And there are a lot of nomads in America that love that life. Matthew McConaughey on this show talked about how he loved a couple of years. He just went RV on him. This was during his period of time when he wanted to get out of rom-coms and get into making serious movies. So he just said to his agent, I'm out of here. And before he got married, and he lived on the road in his RV. A whole bunch of Americans do that. That is not what I'm called to. No, 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 no. I think that Marriott is roughing it. All right. So that's not for me. But I do love driving. Boy, do I love driving. That's why this movie is visually quite breathtaking, because they'll take you everywhere in the West where the nomads go, and it's desert and it's cold. And it's the real life of real people who live in real RVs and vans on the road. And so it could be uplifting, but very sad, because she did not prepare to be without a spouse. I told the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt, you know, I'm going to go first because it's simply not possible for me to go to heaven second, because I don't have a bank card. I don't know how to access any of the accounts, and I don't know where the peanut butter is. Really, I'll be down to the almonds in about a week, and then the pizza delivery guys who already know me, my first name, are going to basically put me on a schedule for delivery. But I told her, you're not going RV on me. She said, absolutely not. I got a family and a bunch of friends, and I'm one of those people who also believe, you know, maybe 30 days of grieving and then go out there and start dating, if you're a woman. If you're a man, I'm not really sure I could ever adjust after the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt to anyone less than perfect. But in any event, I think that Nomadland is a deeply dark view of what happens when you don't intentionally work on your life, preparing for retirement, and one or the other of you, if you're a couple, going first, and you don't work on your friends. But then I also thought to myself, no God. Even if you were a complete atheist, you should join a church. I wrote that years ago. If only to be in community with a bunch of people who care about you, know you by your first name, like the Friends song. If I had a producer, we'd go out with the Friends song. So I want to give you a tip if you're one of these people. Here's a little discovery. Podcasting is changing the world, the way the world absorbs information, because they're tired. People are tired of cable news. They don't like a lot of programming, and they don't want to be stuck to a screen or a computer, but they like listening. And my friend John Campbell used to tell me he'd wake up in the middle of the night and listen to Art Bell, because that's just what he did. I can't understand that. If you're one of those people that wake up in the middle of the night, you need to know about podcasting. If you like to listen to sound as you go to sleep, you want to learn something right to the moment that you fall asleep, you can't read with the light off, I want to tell you that podcasts are out there. Now, I personally use either Tim Keller or Bishop Barron. Bishop Barron, though, does an interview which is not conducive to drifting off. And Tim Keller can sometimes be so arresting and interesting that it's also not conducive to lifting off. And you have to, you know, there are timers on the machine. Get your kids to show you. But here's the shortcut. You open up your iPhone or your iPad to Google. Type in Tim Keller podcast or Bishop Barron podcast. I'm looking at the Tim Keller Sermons podcast by Gospel and Light. I listened to one yesterday on the Sermon on the Mount, which may be the best. I've heard a lot of sermons on the Sermon on the Mount since it's the essence of Christ's teaching. But he gave a remarkable, 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 remarkable sermon on the Sermon on the Mount. I'm looking for what it was called. And I listened to it twice yesterday. It was an overview. It was just extraordinary. It was that good. And there's a series on the Sermon on the Mount, of which I will be listening to all of them. But the Norms of the Kingdom is what it's called. It was delivered on March 10th. There are 100 Timothy Keller sermons online. So if you Google Tim Keller, podcast, Tim Keller Sermons Online, Tim Keller Gospel and Life. You'll find those. And then you hit one, and it plays for 20 to 30 minutes. You know, Presbyterians are not allowed to go over 25 minutes. Catholics are not allowed to go over 13. Archbishop Chaput, if you are listening, I hope you will start a podcast soon and deliver it. The downside to Archbishop Chaput would give just a straight homily. I don't know if they recorded them. They had to post them. Bishop Barron does interviews, which are more difficult. I do two podcasts. I do one podcast called The Hugh Hewitt Show, Highly Concentrated Hugh, which is designed to give you the news of the day in every interview in The Hugh Hewitt Show. That's the rundown plus interviews. And I'm including this segment today to give a little tutorial on podcasts. I also do The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. Both of them are available at iTunes, at Spotify, at Stitcher, at the Salem Podcast Network. But again, just Google in Hugh Hewitt podcast, and you'll find it in the interview, and you'll see, I think we got 30 episodes up now, and I add new and old, and I keep adding more, and there's always a 5 days a week. I also listen to The Orange and the Brown by the Cleveland Brown sports writers at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Their podcast yesterday was 71 minutes long. They were reviewing the draft. Listened to it twice. You know, did my 6 miles yesterday, as I'm about to brag. And there's lots to fill your day with. You don't drift around aimlessly. She drives, by the way, singing to herself Christmas carols, which is fine, but it's so bleak. Life is not bleak when you're old. I do not believe that. I know it is bleak for some. I know it is. But there are places to live in community on a decent wage in retirement, on Social Security, not alone and on the road. So as breathtakingly beautiful as Nomadland is, it is a cautionary tale about living outside of community and cloistered with just a spouse, cut off from family. And I'm not going to give you the subplot, but when you purposely remove yourself from family, it's bad as you get older. And if you're younger and you're not paying attention to your older family, what goes around comes around, pal, lady. Stay connected, stay in touch. I told people whenever we have dinner now in the new age of post-COVID, I say, what's the best thing about COVID? And among other people, Fetching Mrs. Hewitt has started a weekly Zoom with her siblings and children. Now, I don't, that's not a Hugh Hewitt thing. I prefer solitary one-on-one conversations or listening to podcasts, but they love it. They do it once a week. They yuck it up. They tell stories. What are you doing? Where have you been? And they are a mobile bunch, and they're everywhere in the country. So they have great fun for an hour a week. Other people do that. Just life is not meant to be lived unless you are called to a Carmelite existence alone, but in community. It's also not lived in silence unless you're called to that, and very few people are. Learn how to use podcasts. Learn how to listen to Tim Keller and Bishop Barron and Hugh Hewitt. Just learn. Learn, learn. It takes about 5 minutes, and then you'll be great at it. You'll love it, and you'll thank me for it. Same reason you thank me for relieffactor.com. It's that time of the morning. There it is. Got to drop this down on Urban Meyer and the Jacksonville Jaguars because you're going to run some tough practices for – there's not going to be any kind of Clemson practices down there. No, no, no. These are Ohio State practices for those, Mr. Lawrence. You're going to need your relieffactor.com. I carry in curcumin, resveratrol, and omega, the four natural supplements, the only supplements I take. Why? I do take a vitamin too, but because if you're moving, if you're active, and I got 6 miles in yesterday before the rains came, and it was, you know, trundling. Anything over 10 minutes a mile is trundling. It's not really running anymore. And I'm past my running years unless I'm really, really crazy for a mile. But get out there and trundle or walk or do something, and relieffactor.com makes it easier for you to do that. Drucker is next. We're going to review reopening in New York, whether it'll save Andrew Cuomo and Gavin Newsom in California. Stay tuned to the Hugh Hewitt Show. That music means America on the Hugh Hewitt Show. David M. Drucker is here. David M. Drucker, senior political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. You see him on cable everywhere. Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm great, Hugh. How are you?
Good. I love your news story. Trump's White House exit diminishes Never Trump faction. Now, the Never Trump faction was pretty small to begin with. Tell us what your reporting shows.
Well, you know, ironically, we could look at this. Well, let me start by saying this. We could look at this as obviously the president retains a lot of support within the party. The voters, yes, but also on Capitol Hill. And for those people, they want to continue to talk about Trump, and they want to continue, they want to further his legacy. But interestingly enough, there are a lot of Republicans who are quietly glad he's out of office, want the party to rebuild with his policy legacy, but not other aspects of his presidency. And they think the only way to do that is to stop talking about him. Don't antagonize him. It causes them problems back home with their voters. And when you poke at Trump, he doesn't like it. And he likes to remind everybody why he is such a major figure in the party. And so part of this is not just that people like Trump in Washington among Republicans, but that there are a lot of people that don't, that feel like the best way for the party to keep the policy legacy, but move on from what they believe are some of the troubling aspects of how he conducted himself in the White House, is to just let it lie. And of course, you have a few Never Trump Republicans or people that are consistent critics that are convinced that won't work and that they have to continue to discuss the post-election period in January 6th. And it is causing a bit of a schism within the House Republican Conference in particular, because one of the biggest Trump critics to emerge from the 6th is Liz Cheney, who's the number 3 ranking House Republican. I don't know that she will survive the month in that position. But this is why Never Trump Republicans, such that they are, without Trump in office, seem to be what I would say further marginalized. They were never a big faction. But with Trump out of office, there's just less of an appetite all the way around for Trump criticism, whether you're talking to supporters or even his quiet critics.
Now, I will say that Liz Cheney, it will be a major mistake for the House Republicans to marginalize Liz Cheney in any way, because you don't build parties by subtraction. You build parties by addition. Richard Nixon has said that, and everyone has listened to him since the time of the Great Exiles and following LBJ. And every Republican out there, you do not build parties and majorities by purging people, but by adding people. More importantly, however, there are maybe a half dozen people, maybe 10, and most of them are my colleagues at NBC and MSNBC, who are Never Trump forever. And that's because they branded themselves that way. And honestly, I don't know if they can write a column without it being about Trump. It's kind of a strange addiction, David Drucker. But it's their brand now, and I think it's increasingly a brand built upon Trump hatred of the left, not affinity on the center right. I think the center right wants to get on with facing up to China and dealing with the inflation that is coming.
I think the center right also wants to get on to focusing on winning back the majorities, and that's another aspect of this view. There are plenty of Republicans who, during Trump's 4 years, avoided the tweets so they wouldn't have to comment on them. And, you know, we can relitigate this ad nauseum. They want to focus on regaining some power so they can blunt the Biden administration's agenda, the taxes, the regulations, and a bunch of other things that we discuss every week. And you don't do that by constantly dividing your colleagues, even some of your colleagues you may disagree with. But you do raise a good point about, you know, some of the Trump criticism. Look, I think when Trump was in office and had he won a second term, still been in office, you could argue, theoretically, look, there's a place for a Never Trump Republican sort of criticism, somebody who's still conservative, believes in the platform, but has particular issues with Trump. I think for a lot of Republicans that are in office now, the thinking is, look, he lost. He's not president. What is the point of continuing to bring this up? They would respond that the party continues to bury what happened on January 6th and just rubber stamp it and say it's fine.
And let me respond to that. Actually, it doesn't. It's been unanimously condemned by every Republican. And to my friends like Tim Miller, who I've tried to help out throughout his young career, they got to get off this stuff or it's going to ruin their careers. Why? because it's not interesting. It's got nothing to do with anything that's going on in people's lives right now. But obsessing over Trump, while it provided steady income and a certain number of eyeballs, that is like investing in buggy whips, David Drucker.
It is interesting. I think one thing that people who don't understand the Never Trump universe may not realize is most of them, from my observation, understand that the party has evolved and that the way they would like the party to operate is not going to happen.
And by the way,
understand the position, David, that they're in, but they don't know what else to do about it.
What they should do is pick a specialty in policy world and do it. But it's not a universe. It's not a solar system. It's not a planet. It's not a moon. It's an asteroid that's gone. It went by, and unlike Haley, it's not coming back. David M. Drucker, thank you, my friend. Stay tuned, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt, inside the Beltway, talking with Byron York of the Washington Examiner and Fox News. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Doing well.
I am wondering if you have yet to read this book, The Tyranny of Big Tech, by Senator Josh Hawley.
I have not, but he tells me daily that it's the bestseller on Amazon.
Well, it is quite a remarkable book. Now, I think it's unique that the Republicans in the Senate, specifically Hawley, Senators Sass and Cotton, have written good books that are unrelated to biography, meaning that Ben Sass has written Them, Why We Hate Each Other and How to Heal, as well as The Vanishing American Adult. Tom Cotton has written Sacred Duty, It's Soldiers Tour at Arlington National Cemetery, little biography, but mostly it's a history of the old guard. And now comes Hawley with The Tyranny of Big Tech. So for all the people who are out there saying the Republicans are stuck on Trump, I just point to the fact there's a long list of substantive arguments within the Republican caucus, which are enduring and deep.
You know, you make an excellent point about the books, because everybody, it's a law. Everybody who's considering a run for president a year or two beforehand has to write a really stupid book about what America needs. And it's a little bit of bio, and it's a lot of talking points. And it's not a real book about a topic. And you're absolutely right. These Republicans have. And so it's, I think it bodes well for 2024.
It does. And Josh Hawley's book actually attempts to exhume and reestablish the little r Republican tradition in American politics as an opposition to big government, big corporations. And it's I'm going to talk to him this week at length. And I just want to, you will enjoy it as yourself, an intellectual who is disguised as a reporter. Let's talk about your daily memo, because I think this is, well, that's true. I think you're one of our very few intellectuals disguised as a reporter.
Don't call me that.
I know you don't want that to get out. And I'm sorry. Whenever anyone says that about David Brooks, right, he objects too. You are writing about Joe Biden and his illusory mandate. And, you know, I looked at the headline. I said, do we have to go over this again? And I'm glad you did, because you provided the history. There is no mandate. Do you want to explain what a mandate really looks like?
Well, first of all, I'm sure you and all of our listeners have heard so many commentators refer to Joe Biden as FDR or LBJ. That he can take his place alongside Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the New Deal, Lyndon Baines Johnson, and the Great Society. And the point here is simply that Biden does not have the mandate from the voters to do big things that those presidents had. And when voters want presidents to do big things, they give them big victories, not only in their own elections, but in Congress. And if you look back, first of all, we know what Biden won the presidency by, 306 electoral votes. He won the popular vote by 7 million votes, but he won the Electoral College by a pretty narrow margin, actually, 43,000 votes in three states. Roosevelt, 1932, wins 472 electoral votes. 1936, wins 523 electoral votes. Alf Landon, the Republican, won 8. He won Vermont and Maine. By the way, back then, It only required 266 votes for victory. In 1964, Johnson landslide. He wins 486 electoral votes. So these leaders themselves were given big mandates. And then their congressional majorities were huge. In 1932, when Roosevelt elected, Democrats win 313 seats in the House. The next time, 34, they win 322 seats in the House. In 1936, they win 334 seats in the House. This is a huge majority. The Republicans in that year won 88 House seats. It was one-party government. In the Senate, 32, they have 59 seats. They have 96 seats in the whole Senate. 34, they have 69 seats. In 1936, Democrats controlled 76 seats in the Senate. Republicans had 16. Okay, similar situation in the 1960s. In 1964, when Johnson wins, Democrats win 295 seats in the House and 68 seats in the Senate. So when the voters want you to do something big, Social Security, Medicare, they give you a big mandate. They do not give you 218 seats in the House, which Democrats have right now, or a Senate that is tied 50-50.
I'm also going to indulge in a little nitpicking here, Byron. When FDR won his big landslide in 32, it was a rejection of Hoover as much as it was an embrace of FDR. FDR might not be counted as a great president. Indeed, I don't think he would be, but for the fact he won World War II. It's the second term. It's the third term and the fourth election, which he didn't get very far into his fourth term, for which he is justly remembered as a great wartime leader. He put the country back into a recession in 1938, and the big thing that he tried for in 1937-38, court packing, was repudiated by his own party. LBJ is remembered as a great president for his Civil Rights Act, begun by Kennedy and completed by him in 64, and then the Voting Rights Act in 65. The Great Society was a failure. So when I see our young friends in the business making FDR and LBJ comparisons, I think to myself, they know not what they say, because domestically, these are largely failures. Social Security being the exception to that, Medicare being the exception to that, but the National Recovery Act, the Civilian Conservation Corps, the innovation that Roosevelt tried, yes, that was interesting, but it was his wartime presidency that succeeded. LBJ's presidency is a disaster on domestic policy side, and he had the majority.
First of all, Social Security and Medicare are big exceptions. Second of all, I agree with all of that, but the fact is, did they have a mandate from the voters to do some of the things that they did and to aim high and to play it big? Yes, they did. There's a scene that occurred in 1993, if some of our listeners may remember. Bill Clinton is just elected. He appoints his wife, Hillary Clinton, to head his premier policy initiative, which is national health care. He wants to enact national health care, a Democratic goal for generations. And so she is really doing it quite arrogantly, telling members of Congress what she's going to do, and they can get on board with her. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the wise Democratic senator at the time, takes her aside and says, these really huge things like Medicare, like Social Security, they do not squeak through Congress with one vote. They either get 70 votes in the Senate or they fail. And she told him to get lost. He didn't know what he was talking about. And she went on to fail. So I think that is kind of a law of political gravity that is still in force in our politics today. And that with a 50-50 Senate, I mean, there is no majority party in the Senate. Democrats control on the virtue of the vice president's tie-breaking vote. In a 50-50 Senate, you're not going to get the enormous things that Joe Biden wants to pass.
Although my other caution, built on Jonah Goldberg's excellent books, Liberal Fascism, and his second book, whose name is now eluding me, which will come to me shortly.
Clichés, I think.
Yeah, thank you. The Wilson, who did not earn a mandate by any means, he just simply exploited a division among the Republicans, nevertheless put into place progressive government that haunted the United States for the next century and continues to. So Biden can get a lot done, is doing a lot via the administrative state, but he does not have a legislative mandate to pass these kind of things. And I believe the Democrats are going to buck at him on this second reconciliation, on this idea of immigration reform built on reconciliation maneuvers and on another $2 trillion. Do you agree with me, Byron?
Well, your mention of a legislative mandate versus an executive mandate is important here because Biden is already, I mean, day one, he's using his executive power. But you're right. The kind of the irony of the debate about the filibuster is that it assumes Democrats are united enough on some issue to muster their 50 votes and then with Kamala Harris's tie-breaking vote pass something if the filibuster were broken. But the fact is they're not fully on board. And I don't think there has always been in the Senate some group of people who were in the majority who remember what it was like in the minority not want to get run over when they are in the minority in the future.
100%.
There are others who say, to hell with it, let's go. But there are always enough members in the Senate who realize that they're in the majority today, but they could be in the minority tomorrow.
And they want their authority as a senator intact, at least in part. Byron York on Twitter, and you ought to subscribe to his daily memo newsletter. If you go to the tweet link I just provided, you can subscribe, get it every day. It's the best written newsletter in town. Stay tuned, America. I'll be right back on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
There's no time to waste in this famous goodbye. There's angels landing.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, 5 for Fighting, back on the road soon, as is most of America. Broadway reopening, but John Andrazik is great on the USO trips for more than a decade. I'm so glad he's back on the road. I'm joined now by Admiral Stavridis, who, of course, has been the former commander of NATO. And that's why I wanted to talk to you in your role as former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, Admiral Stav. How are you this morning?
Doing great, Hugh. Glad to hear Broadway lights are going back on. I agree.
Are you out and about yet? Are you back on the road again for Washington Speaker's Bureau?
I am, and I'm doing about 1 to 2 trips a month. Normally, I'm in the 4 to 6 a month kind of range between my job at the Carlyle Group and doing the speaking and doing a bunch of things. My big event coming up in May is I'm the commencement speaker with an honorary degree at SWANE, otherwise known as the University of the South. It'll be my 5th or 6th time doing a commencement address, and I just love doing those. I love being
terrific. They'll want to hear about 2034 as well, which remains a firecracker hot bestseller. And I told everyone that you keep saying the only thing you got wrong is the date. And I keep telling everyone, if you don't want to study hard on China, at least get smart on China by reading the Stavridis book. Admiral, what years were you Supreme Allied Commander of NATO?
2009 to 2013, Hugh, 4 years, which is the longest in recent U.S. history.
In those 4 years, how many American troops and how many NATO troops total were deployed in Afghanistan?
About 150,000.
All right. With that backdrop, I would like to play a 3-minute clip of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talking with Fareed Zakaria yesterday about the Afghanistan withdrawal and then get your commentary on what she has to say in the situation in Afghanistan. Here is the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Well, it's been made, and I know it's a very difficult decision. This is what we call a wicked problem. You know there are consequences, both foreseen and unintended, of staying and of leaving. The president has made the decision to leave. And I think that our government has to focus on two huge consequences. One, the potential collapse of the Afghan government and a takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban, probably with a resumption of civil war in certain parts of the country, but a largely Taliban-run government at some point in the not-too-distant future. How do we help and protect the many, many thousands of Afghans who worked with the United States and NATO who worked with American and other NATO-connected contractors who stood up and spoke out for women's rights and human rights. I hope that the administration, in concert with the Congress, will have a very large visa program and will begin immediately to try to provide that channel for so many Afghans to utilize so that they are not left in danger. There will also be, I fear, a huge refugee outflow. And of course, the second big set of problems revolves around a resumption of activities by global terrorist groups, most particularly Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And I agree with a recent article that you've written, Fareed, that, you know, we've seen a really sharp drop in both capacity and action on behalf of Islamic terrorist groups. I don't think, though, we can count on that staying in a downward spiral if the Taliban continue to provide refuge to international terrorist groups. And sadly, ever since George W. Bush asked them, all the way up to the efforts at negotiation in the last months of the Trump administration, the Taliban has never been willing to separate itself from Al-Qaeda. And we know that the current head of Al-Qaeda, who had been bin Laden's deputy, al-Zawahiri, is still somewhere in Afghanistan and Pakistan, biding his time. And so I think these two huge sets of issues have got to be addressed. I mean, it's one thing to pull out troops that have been, you know, supporting security in Afghanistan, supporting the Afghan military, leaving it pretty much to fend for itself. But we can't afford to walk away from the consequences of that decision.
All right. So, Admiral, your response as someone who formerly commanded the NATO deployment there.
I agree with Secretary Clinton. And during the period of time I commanded it, by the way, she was the Secretary of State for a portion of that. I worked with her very directly on those issues via the NATO alliance. And I think her concerns are well placed. Also, her point that there are a lot of, as my old boss, Don Rumsfeld, I spent 2 years as his senior military assistant, effectively the military chief of staff. He would say there are some unknown unknowns out there. And there are, as Secretary Clinton says, some known unknowns out there. In other words, we don't know how this is going to turn out. Let me make a couple additional points in response, then we can just go back and forth a bit. First of all, a key is going to be whether or not, and I hope we do, fund the Afghan security forces going forward. It's a pretty small bill, a few billions a year. It can be spread amongst our allies as it currently is. And, you know, there are 300,000 Afghan security forces in the field fighting the Taliban. There's a reason the Taliban haven't gotten in their crummy little SUVs and come driving into Kabul and all the other cities in Afghanistan, and it's the Afghan security forces. They're the ones fighting. That's why we haven't had a combat death in 14 months. They've had a lot. So if we fund them, as we did with the South Vietnamese armed forces, they held off the North for about 2 years. Saigon fell and the helicopters lifted off the roof when we cut off the funding. So point one, let's fund the Afghan security forces. Point two is we still have a big contractor presence in that country, probably close to 20,000 contractors. Some of them will leave because they're supporting the U.S. military, of course, but a lot of them are there doing humanitarian work. A lot are doing intelligence work. The CIA is certainly going to have to continue to be involved there. We have to protect our embassy. So we've got to be thinking that package through how many contractors will stay if we are going to withdraw the military troops. And then third and finally, Hugh, I think an important point to be made is the overall strategic value of Afghanistan as a location, its geography. right on the border of the two great power nations we're competing with. So having access to get into Afghanistan, even when the troops are not permanently there, will be important so that we can come in and stomp out any remnants of the Islamic State that flare up so that we can have a presence there on that very important strategic border next to Russia and China. So I agree with Secretary Clinton, and there's three additional points I would make.
So, Admiral, I'm curious if you are as pessimistic as most people are about the fate of the Afghan security forces. I'm not. History does not have to repeat itself, and this is not the South Vietnamese army. This is a highly motivated group of people that have experienced the Taliban in their memory 20 years ago. And Bagram is there, and we have NATO support and NATO funding. However, there are now checkpoints, I gather, to the south and to the east of Kabul. Is the north and the west of Kabul fairly secured? Is Bagram, in your view, fairly secure from a Taliban offensive?
I believe it is. And, I always say about the Afghans, they might not be the best doctors, lawyers, and poets, but Afghans know how to fight. That's their culture. And if trained and equipped, I think the Afghan security forces are not going to simply collapse in the face of the Taliban. I think to answer the question, am I pessimistic? I'd say there's about, unfortunately, it's about an even chance right now. If the U.S. was staying and we kept a mission there, I think it would be more 2 in 3 that we would succeed over time with the idea of integrating the Taliban, that's the vision, into the government and coming to, a peaceful conclusion to this thing. Now those odds go down to something like a coin flip, assuming we continue to fund. And by the way, geographically, you're correct. In the east and typically to the south around Kandahar, more active Taliban areas. In the far west, Herat on the Iranian border, relatively secure and prosperous. And up to the north, where the Germans, interestingly, have been embedded for a long, long period of time, Kunduz, it's called, those are fairly secure areas. So the place isn't going to immediately fall apart. And again, the key is funding it, maintaining intelligence there. Bagram, the base, which is in the vicinity of Kabul, is very key. I think the Afghan security forces can handle this if we keep the funding going. And by the way, the guy who ought to know, and he's opined on it publicly, is my good friend, you know him well, General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And he has said, could come out okay, could come out very badly. I think he would probably agree with me. It's a kind of a coin flip at this point, but a key is going to be maintaining funding.
Quick exit question, Admiral. What is Iran's strategic interest? For the Taliban to take the entire country or for it to remain divided with its area on its border secure for Iran?
The latter, obviously. And recall, the Taliban did not enjoy a warm and chummy relationship with their co-religionists across the border. The Taliban are Sunnis, and of course, the Iranians are Shia. The Taliban are Afghans and the Iranians are Persians. Not a lot of love lost, as the saying goes, across that border.
Now, it's a fascinating strategic issue. We have to pray for the women of Afghanistan, but also for our allies in the Afghan national government. Admiral James Stavridis, always a pleasure. Congratulations on the continued success of 2034. You and Elliot Ackerman have done something I haven't seen people do before. Rookie novelist hit the Tom Clancy marks on Amazon. You want to go out and get that, America. 2034 by James Stavridis, Elliot Ackerman.
The reason I'm bothering to do this is I keep hearing on the press, Biden's going to raise your taxes. Anybody making less than $400,000 a year will not pay a single penny in taxes. And we will not increase the deficit either, unlike the last gigantic tax cut, which increased the deficit by $2 trillion. It's about balancing the system and growing the economy. It means wealthy investors no longer pay lower marginal tax rates than their secretary pays, the secretary in their office.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. That was President Biden yesterday. I'm joined by Michael Shear, Chief White House Correspondent for The New York Times. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I am good. Hope you're well, too, sir.
I am. I am curious, though, if you believe that statement that the president made is correct. Not anyone making under $400,000 a year will see their taxes rise.
Well, I don't know. I mean, look, these are statements that presidents have made for decades when they kind of monkey with the tax system. You know, Barack Obama made some similar claims about I think it was under 250,000 when he was doing healthcare, I believe. And so I think, you know, clearly they're trying to target that. They're trying to make it so that the increases, the rates that are going up are targeting people who make above that. Whether or not when the fine print is done, there are, pieces that affect folks who make less than that. I'm a skeptical reporter. I sort of think that one of the things that we all need to do is to look at that fine print, and hopefully the lawmakers will do that too, so that they can see whether that claim is actually true.
Do you know if he means all taxpayers, or does he mean joint taxpayers? Because this is not fine print. The $400,000 claim, if applied to joint taxpayers, it means half as much as it means if it applies to all taxpayers. It would be $800,000 for joint filers, $400,000 for single filers. He never, ever declares. Does the staff ever make it explicit from the front of the press room?
You know, that's a good question. I haven't been our chief reporter covering the details of his proposal. I believe that perhaps what they're talking about is $400,000 for a household, which, as you say, would be less for an individual. But I'm not 100% certain about that.
You see, no one is 100% certain. And I kind of consider that a failure on the part of that part of the media that allows to interact with the president, and certainly doesn't include me, to force out what is the key detail. Does this apply to two people making $200,000 each, or a household or individual? Because that's like doubling and tripling the number of people on whom this will fall. Put aside all the other objections being made to the capital gains and the death tax. Next to the death tax, he has not been asked about this yet, the stepped-up basis, which I've discussed with you again. Does anyone at the New York Times care about that? Because it will impact. I'm going to talk to Senator Cotton. It will destroy family-owned timber businesses, family-owned farms, family-owned car washes if he's successful in that. Does anyone interact with him on that?
Well, I don't know if anybody has interacted directly with the president on that issue. I do know that we have a team of people who are sort of focused on, you know, both in our congressional coverage and in our sort of economic and budget coverage here in the Bureau. We have a group of people who have been focused on these details and have been writing stories since the initial proposals have come out from the White House about all of the different pieces that are included. Now, look, the truth is, this is a massive proposal, and I'm not sure that we've gotten our way through every piece of it. But I do think, to your point, the questions about what Biden's proposal would do to something like the death tax and how that would affect different parts of the community, it's an important part of the story. And, you know, I think it's right for somebody like you to hold the working White House press corps to account, to say, look, it's your job to be reporting on this, and we should be doing that.
Now, my last question, which is an easy one for me to ask, but a difficult one for you to answer, is legacy media giving him batting practice as opposed to high, hard ones inside?
I mean, look, I don't think so. I'm not the most independent or unbiased person to ask, because I'm a member of that group. I will tell you that today on the front page of the newspaper, I authored a pretty hard hitting piece about his, reversal on the refugee program. And if my emails and Twitter responses are any indication, the anger from pro-Biden people at my reporting because I'm being too tough on him, you know, suggests that at least in some cases we're being pretty tough on him. And I think that should continue.
Mostly, I want to find out what's going to happen to Americans. I'm glad refugee 62,000 number is coming in. I read your story in the first hour, Michael. But I do think we need to be very clear. We don't know what he's proposing because it hasn't been reported. But not by Michael Scheer. He is doing his job. And Scheer M on Twitter. Thank you, Michael. Hour number three, straight ahead, America, on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Say it ain't so, Fred Barnes from the Washington Examiner. Senior columnist Fred Barnes announced in his most recent column he is retiring. Fred, what is this? You can't retire. You're too young to retire.
Well, I don't know about that, but let me put it this way. I should have put semi-retiring. I mean, I can still type, and I still have some thoughts. And I still think Joe Biden and the left are ruining America. And I'm going to say so, just not quite as often.
Oh, okay. But you will continue to write for the Washington Examiner?
Yeah, but not every week.
Oh, that's okay. That's not retirement.
Yeah, well, that's what I figured, too. I'm old enough, you know. And I look, you know, we got I'm hoping that the Washington Wizards make some real dent in the NBA playoffs. I want to go to the games.
Don't count on that, Fred. Fred, how old are you?
78.
Oh, my gosh. I guess you get to go to semi-retired at 78. I was going to say, you and Prager are not allowed to retire. People count on you too much.
Okay. Well, look, I wouldn't want to retire, but I do want to have flexibility. You know,
now, I have an objection, though. I have an objection to the illustration that accompanied your retirement column. You're holding a Wizards large soft drink. That's fine. You've got a Bible, which is absolutely appropriate. But you're holding a Red Sox mitt and ball when that mm-hmm. should be a Cavaliers cap and otherwise an undesecrated Fred Barnes would be there. You've got an orange and blue tie on, but most people won't get that. The Steelers fans will never understand that.
Well, that's a University of Virginia tie.
I know, but the Steelers won't get that.
Look, all four children of mine went to UVA. I did. I now have two grandchildren at the University of Virginia. Yeah, and since I have 10 grandchildren in all, I think some more will go there. And look, let me tell you about the Red Sox. You don't know this about my father. My father, many, many years ago in the 30s, was the coach of the baseball team of the Presidio of Monterey. You know where that is.
Oh, sure.
California. And he was in the Army. He just got out of West Point, and he coached the baseball team. And he had a young man on that team who was doing Army duty in the summer. I think he was 17, and his name was Dominic DiMaggio.
Oh, my gosh. Dom DiMaggio played for your dad?
He did. He was just, and of course, he's famous as Joe DiMaggio's young brother. And who did Dominic DiMaggio play for 10, 12 years as the center fielder? He was for the Red Sox.
And, sadly.
And had an autograph ball by him. Now I have the autograph ball. It's made me a Red Sox fan.
Sadly. My grandpa went to 40 home Indians openers, and so I have got his Feller ball around here somewhere that Bob Feller signed for him. But I got to tell you, Fred, I hope you write an occasional column on sports, but I want to return to the column. And I'm going to put you on the spot, so I will give you a second to think about most important thing you wrote. The most important thing you wrote for me, I've told you this before, is a cover story for the New Republic in the 80s called The Parasite Culture of Washington. It actually played heavily in the decision of the fetching Mr. Hewitt and I to leave Washington, D.C. in 1989 and go back to California because of that article. What do you think is the most important thing you've written?
Well, that was right. I love that piece, the parasite culture, and it's only gotten worse in Washington. People living off all the money that's spent there, and urging more and more to be spent. My favorite piece was one of the last ones I wrote for the Weekly Standard, and that is called "The Real Ronald Reagan." I was told by one of his former aides who was at the Hoover Institution that, look, if you really want to understand Ronald Reagan And if you really want to understand how great he was, read everything that Reagan wrote. And there's not a great deal of it, but there's a good bit. I read every bit of it. And the book that is the most important, of course, was his diary. You read his diary and you realize what a great man he was. And you realize that he was a terrific leader. You realize he knew so much more than his age. You know, a lot of his aides at the White House, I would talk to him all the time, and they didn't understand him. You know, they thought they knew a lot, but gee, that the president, you know, he doesn't know much. He was so far ahead of them. He knew exactly where it was going. How do you think he won the war with the Soviet Union and set them back decades? Because Reagan understood that. Reagan was a great reader. He'd been reading for years. He'd been fighting communists since the 1940s. He also recognized something Joe Biden does, that if you want to give the economy a boost, you don't raise taxes, you cut taxes.
Well, that new tax program by the president is going to be a disaster. Have you read Karen Tumulty's fine new biography of Nancy Reagan, which I did? I interviewed Karen a couple of weeks ago. I have a podcast over at The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. It's a terrific book, Fred, that will make you, I'm sure, happy as it recalls moments large and small. Have you had a chance to see it yet?
No, I haven't. I mean, I know Karen, but I haven't seen it. And, you know, one of the things you learned from reading Reagan's long, 900-page diary of his 8 years as president, you realize that the thing that he cared the most in his life was Nancy. He loved her. He would get Reagan, if she was away doing some event somewhere and she was gone that evening, he was lonely. Was unhappy. He wanted her there.
100% confirmed by Karen. I am curious, of all the White Houses you have covered, Fred, and all the First Ladies you've covered, First Lady Jill Biden was with the president yesterday visiting a Virginia school. Into what lane does Dr. Jill Biden fit at this point?
Well, Joe Biden, you have to remember a couple of things about Biden. One, of course, I could be mean to him about his current wife and how she happened to become his wife. But anyway, Joe Biden's in a lane by some presidents, a number of them, who never have an idea of their own. They've only picked them up from other people tell them what to do. And Biden, of course, has never had an idea in 40 years in Washington of his own. And now he's finally, who's he listening to now? He's listening to the far left, the progressives, are people who want to turn America into a country of everybody having the same amount of money, which means if you happen to be a very smart person and make a lot of money, they want to tax all your money. And if you're one of these people who doesn't even want to go out and get a job, they want to give you money. So everybody's equal. Look, there's been a lot of writing on this. You know, George Will's great book, The Conservative Sensibility, focuses on this and on what progressives really want to do. And now they have Biden joining them and leading them in trying to do it.
Now, I thought you were going to say that First Lady Biden is in the Nancy Reagan lane, because I think that's where she is. Not particularly ideological, but fiercely protective of her husband. I don't know the origin story you alluded to, but I think she is just going to be a fighter left, right. But you're right about his politics. He is governing so far to the left, Fred. When Reagan was elected, he was elected as a conservative. When Nixon was elected, he was elected as a center right person. When Obama was elected, he was elected as a leftist. But Joe Biden was elected as a centrist, and he's anything but.
Yeah. So And over the years, look, I've talked to him many times over the years as a senator. He's a very genial guy. And I don't think I ever heard a left-wing idea from him that he spoke of favorably. You know, he's the kind of guy that he got along so well with all those very right-wing Southern Democrats. You know, I remember one of the events I went to. It was when Jesse Helms no left winger Jesse was leaving as I think it was as a chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who came to give the speech praising him for being such a great member and such a great chairman? Joe Biden. That was Joe Biden. It's not this Biden with all these crazy ideas now. And I don't see how Biden is going to be able to continue to do this. All these things that are not his ideas that are being stuck in his mind. One is they won't work. And the second one is his. I just think his body is going to eventually reject a lot of them.
You are 100% correct on eventually. It just isn't going to work. Fred Barnes, follow him at Fred Barnes on Twitter. He will continue to write. Thank goodness he said it ain't so. Retirement doesn't mean retirement. It means semi-retirement. Thank you, Fred, for a million columns and kindnesses. Don't go anywhere, America. He'll continue to be a guest on the Hugh Hewitt Show as well. I'll be right back on Same Said Show shortly. Stay tuned.
Stars are gonna shine tonight. Tell me where the good men go.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, joined now by United States Senator Tom Cotton. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Good to be back on with you.
Thank you. I want to begin with President Biden's statement yesterday. Get your comment on it. Cut number three.
The reason I'm bothering to do this is I keep hearing on the press Biden's going to raise your taxes. Anybody making less than $400,000 a year will not pay a single penny in taxes.
Stop.
And we will not increase.
What do you make of that, Senator Cotton? What he intended to say and what he said and what is true?
Well, Hugh, obviously false on its face because they're about to institute a massive marriage penalty because that figure applies not just to individuals but to two-income households as well. But if you take a step back, all these taxes, of course, are going to hit working families in their bottom line. Sure, Joe Biden can raise taxes on businesses, but businesses are ultimately tax collectors, not taxpayers. They're just going to raise prices on consumers to cover those taxes. It's also going to be less jobs for their employees. So obviously less take-home pay if you don't have a job as well. So Joe Biden's statement is obviously false.
It's false on its face. It's false on the details. It is also false in refusing to admit we have an inflation problem, Senator, and it has been recognized by everyone except the Federal Reserve and Joe Biden. It's real and it's a tax.
Yeah, Hugh, unfortunately, if you look at almost any commodity market, you can look at the lumber markets, oil and gas, things that are used in basic construction like copper or tar, consistently prices are going up. Sometimes in the case of lumber, prices are going up to record levels.
I believe the 2x4, I've been helping Dwayne in his backyard, 2x4s and 4x4s, they are 100% higher than they were a year ago. 100% higher in 1 year. That cannot be limited to timber.
Yeah. So, Hugh, lumber at the 1,000 board foot level, which is how these things are measured, are actually four times as high as they were last year at this time at the outset of the pandemic. Some of that is related to the closures of mills during the pandemic, but more of it is related to bad policy, Hugh. Look, there can be all the demand for lumber that you want from your builder or at Home Depot or Lowe's, but if mills can't turn logs into boards, you're not going to be able to meet that demand. And they can't right now. The one reason they can't is because many mill workers can make more money staying at home thanks to the Democrats' spending blowout last month, increasing unemployment payments by another $400 a month until September, at a time the economy was already recovering. If you look at Joe Biden's tax increases, if they eliminate the stepped-up basis at death and if they treat death as a capital gains tax event, it will be devastating to the timber industry. There is no industry that is a better definition of a cash or a asset-rich cash poor industry than timber. It takes 25 to 40 years from the time you plant a tree to the time you can harvest it and turn it into a piece of lumber. And if you change the long-term tax treatment for something like the timber industry, you simply discourage people from planting, growing, and harvesting trees, which ultimately hits households in their bottom line when they're trying to build a treehouse for their kids or add a deck to their home or build a new home.
Let's talk for a moment about the unemployment. I do not fault anyone for making economically rational decisions. And if, in fact, one can put more money into their household and their pocket and their kids by staying at home and collecting unemployment while doing a side gig that is not disqualified by law. I have no criticism of economically efficient decision making. I do have criticism of Congress that failed to anticipate that behavior, Senator.
Yeah, Hugh, again, the bill that was passed in March was totally unnecessary. You know, it was totally unlike the situation we faced last March with the CARES Act at the very outset of this pandemic. By March, it was more than clear that the economy was robustly recovering and people were getting back to work because we had vaccines in record-breaking times. None of this is happening because of Joe Biden and the Democrats' policies. It's happening in spite of those things. It's happening because we have vaccines that are allowing people to get back to normal. Democratic governors are finally reopening their states. And it was foolhardy to extend unemployment benefits at enhanced levels all the way through September. You're right that people are making economically rational decisions. And in some cases, it's the right decision for their family, too, because their Democratic governors won't let their schools reopen. So they got to take care of their kids, too. But
that's where we're going next. Yeah, I want to go to that.
Yeah, that has follow-on effects.
You were on Fox yesterday. In fact, I'll play the clip that I played earlier to give context to the audience. Cut number 13, Senator Cotton on Fox yesterday.
The CDC is a thoroughly politicized agency. Most Americans disregard their advice on things like steaks and hamburgers and beers. Increasingly, they should disregard their advice when it comes to school reopening. Schools need to be open.
100% agree, Senator. I want to cover a couple things about CDC. First of all, their pause in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine will end up killing, I can't count as high in all 3 hours as the number of people it's going to kill, especially in the third world. Now they are clearly in cahoots with teachers unions. What do you do about that?
Well, Hugh, the CDC has a long trail of errors behind it, starting last February when they botched the early testing that would allow us to get ahead of the pandemic faster. But now it's clear from the evidence, clear from the recommendations, that they are working in league with the teachers' unions to keep schools closed. There is no reason that schools across America should not be open. And I mean open for real, with teachers in the classroom teaching their students 5 days a week. That's what's been going on in Arkansas for the last 7 months. And to my knowledge, there's no school that's been the source of a major outbreak of the coronavirus. But a lot of teacher unions are trying to use this as a bargaining chip to get more benefits or to get more pay. They're putting the interest of grownups ahead of kids, and I think that's very disappointing. And it's even worse, the CDC is in league with them. It undercuts their expertise and their ability to speak about the public health implications of this virus, just as it does when Anthony Fauci or others go out with two masks, saying that you've got to keep wearing masks in public even after you're vaccinated. We should be telling the American people, especially those who are somewhat nervous about getting the vaccine, in particular the J&J vaccine after the needless pause in distribution, that if you get these vaccines, everything does get back to normal. You can take the masks off. You can stop the social distancing. You can get back to work. You can get back to your kids' sporting events and school events.
Now, let me talk to you a little bit about, Senator, about timber. I want to go back to the timber industry. I don't know if they have an alliance. I drove past yesterday. My new goal in life is to become the executive director of the Pool and Hot Tub Alliance, which I noticed had a headquarters on the way to the movie theater that we went to yesterday. And that seems to me to be quite the great job, the Pool and Hot Tub Alliance. But does the timber industry have an alliance or an association that is trying to inform senators what is going to happen if stepped up basis goes away?
Well, Hugh, lobbyists have their own trade association. So, yes, it's safe to say that the timber industry has a trade alliance as well, and they are undertaking that education effort. You know, they've worked for years and years to try to help senators and congressmen, mostly Democrats, understand the devastating impact the estate tax has had on our timber industry, especially locally owned timber industries as opposed to multinationals. But really, if you eliminate the stepped-up basis, which for the benefit of the Browns fans, Hugh,
no, we had the best draft, A+, all three.
A pretty good draft. But when you eliminate the stepped up basis, which is, you know, the owner of a timber industry passes on and the children inherit it at current market value, not what the owner valued it at 50 years ago when he inherited it or when he started it. And then when you treat death as a capital gains event, so think about that. You die and you hold an asset, often a very illiquid asset, like a tree that's got to grow for 40 years. you say, okay, you got a tax on the gain that's been locked up in that asset. That really is just another kind of estate tax. And in some ways, it's worse than the estate tax because the exemptions are lower. And under the Biden plan, the rates would be even higher. You'd see what we see again, time and time with the estate tax, which is locally owned timber industry or timber companies are selling out to multinationals. And that almost always means a loss of jobs. It certainly means a loss of community sports for things like the local Little League or the local Chamber of Commerce or the high school football scoreboard.
Steve Scalise, GOP whip in the House, and Alfredo Ortiz, who's the CEO of the Job Creator Network. They are a sponsor of this show. I always have to declare that. Join JCN.com. Both don't want to call it stepped up basis. They both say nobody understands that. It sounds like it's a millionaire's benefit. It's not. And Alfredo suggested calling it a success tax because it's going to hit small businesses as well as farms and timber businesses. It's just a disaster for the economy. And I can't believe Democrats are going to support that, Senator. I can't believe they're going to put that in the bill.
I hope they won't. I hope they won't. And it's important for all your listeners from all walks of life to understand just how devastating that tax would be for their communities. I mean, just think, Hugh, about a local diner. You know, if the land that that diner's been sitting on for 20 or 30 years is appreciated in value, if you take the value of the diner's grills, and its refrigerators and its freezers, all the other fixtures in the building. If you take the revenue that it generates, the goodwill it has, it could easily exceed the threshold for this tax, which means the little mom and pop diner that you've loved eating in for the last 20 or 30 years in your community has to be sold just to pay the tax man at death.
And my friend Hank Adler likes to point out, as he did at town hall this week, many assets by small businesses are leveraged to expand, and therefore they have a mortgage on that small diner because they wanted to add restaurant space during the pandemic. And they are not, and those mortgages have to be paid off. And you could end up upside down if you are the heir. Let me close, though, Senator. You're on Armed Services. One of our big friends in the world is India. Are we doing enough to assist India in the pandemic? Is Team Biden on the case? Because they will not waive the patent protections, and they've studiously avoided saying yes or no to that question.
Well, Hugh, I don't think we should waive patent protections or IP rights for the drug companies that made this vaccine. And they're already licensing those at cost. The reason we got these vaccines at record speed is because of our strong protections for investment and property rights in the United States. However, there are lots and lots of doses that we know we're never going to use in the United States that we could get to India. We should be doing everything we can to support a critical democratic ally on China's southern periphery. And I would like to see us do that even faster.
Do you know if we have actually advanced to any kind of alliance status with India, Senator Cotton? Would you advocate that?
Well, we have an informal relationship called the Quad, Hugh, the democratic countries that kind of surround China's periphery, India, Australia, Japan, and then obviously the United States. And we have a pretty strong and growing defense cooperation agreement with India. I think that it's greatly in America's interest to continue to deepen that relationship with India. They're a country that's very soon going to have more people than China. They occupy a critical spot in global shipping lanes. And of course, they're on China's southern border, and right now they're actually still in kind of a hot war up in the Himalayas. I mean, I know it's cold in the Himalayas, but they've got thousands and thousands of troops facing off against Chinese troops up at the top of the world.
And they've had collisions there. Senator Cotton, thank you as always for joining me. Talk to you again next week. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas.